Good evening. In the news tonight, a new shooting in Ohio of a 13-year-old black boy by a white police officer.
There is something wrong in this country, and it is bringing its epidemic to our city streets.
A settlement in the Sandra Bland case. Bill Bratton's reign as NYPD commissioner is coming to a close.
We believe that what the body cameras show will benefit all of us. We believe they'll help everyone see things from a wide variety of points of view.
And New York State officials are working to ban fracked waste. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Thursday, September 15th, 2016. Beginning with international news, the White House is blaming Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government for preventing humanitarian aid from entering high-need areas of Syria. It's echoing comments earlier today by the UN envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura. Daniel Johnson has more.
Staffan de Mistura said that it was too ambitious to say that there was a cessation of hostilities in Syria days after a ceasefire deal came into force. Nonetheless, the UN Special Envoy for Syria maintained that the truce appears to be holding and covers a substantial part of the country. But as of Thursday, no aid permits have been delivered to the UN's humanitarian agencies by the Syrian government.
The UN is ready to go. Deals. Facilitation letters, i.e. final permission for the UN to actually reach those areas, has not been received. That's a fact.
Despite ongoing administrative obstacles to aid deliveries throughout Syria, the UN Special Envoy said there was a way through for the trucks destined for eastern Aleppo. He said that as part of the US-Russia agreement reached in Geneva last weekend, government and rebel forces would have to pull back from the Castello Road, the main supply route to Aleppo's rebel-held areas. The Castello Highway would also be given so-called special status to guarantee the unimpeded movement of the UN's aid trucks to those in need, at least to eastern Aleppo. For the rest of the country, Mr. de Mistura insisted that he was still waiting for aid permits from the Syrian government, which had been approved more than a week ago. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
The UN says it has 40 trucks ready to distribute aid in the country, and it would prioritize delivery to the embattled, rebel-held eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo. That's where some 250,000 people need help, along with hundreds of thousands more in besieged areas elsewhere in the country. In Paris, protesters and police are clashing over labor laws, which weaken the power of unions. Protesters are throwing planks of wood and Molotov cocktails. Police are firing tear gas and dispersion grenades. The demonstrations are part of a last-ditch effort by unions to dismantle a labor law that weakens their powers. The law adopted this summer allows employees more freedom to extend work weeks and lay off staff. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is applauding the U.S. for increasing military aid to Israel. He said the agreement proves that relations between Israel and the U.S. are strong, powerful. Meanwhile, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling Netanyahu's insistence that Palestinians want the ethnic cleansing of Jews in the West Bank unacceptable and outrageous. Ban told the UN Security Council today that he wanted to be absolutely clear. Settlements are illegal under international law. Israel's stifling and oppressive occupation of Palestinian territory must end, said Ban. He said Israel's decade-long policy that has settled over 500,000 Israelis in Palestinian territory is diametrically opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state. And Ban added that the international community considers settlement expansion an obstacle to peace. In other news, reports regarding former Israeli president, 93-year-old Shimon Peres, says his health is improving, but he remains in serious condition, this after suffering a stroke. In national news, in Columbus, Ohio, a 13-year-old black child is dead, shot by a white police officer responding to a report of an unarmed robbery. This was last night. Police said the 13-year-old Tyree King pulled a BB gun from his waistband. Authorities said it looked like a gun.
We found a gun at the scene near the suspect that we were trying to apprehend, And this is what that gun looked like.
Kim Jacobs is with the Columbus Police Department. She held up a photo showing the similarities.
In addition to this appearance, it also had a laser light attached to it right underneath the barrel. Our officers carry a gun that looks practically identical to this weapon.
Because the officer is white and the boy black, the shooting is being compared to the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland. Police are saying that there are differences, though, between the two cases. Columbus, Ohio Mayor Andrew Ginther.
We have a 13-year-old dead in our city. That's unacceptable. And we as a community need to come to grips with the fact, with such easy access to guns, whether they're firearms or replicas, there is something wrong in this country. And it is bringing its epidemic to our city streets. And a 13-year-old is dead in the city of Columbus because of our obsession with guns and violence. That is not the chief of police responsibility. That is not the director's responsibility. That's not the chairman's responsibility. And it's not exclusively my responsibility. It is our responsibility.
Columbus's mayor says it's time for Columbus, Ohio, and this community to step up and make sure our children, our neighborhoods, our communities are safe. And then there's a settlement in the Sandra Bland case. She died in a Texas jail after being arrested for a minor traffic offense. Bland's family sued the county and the Texas Department of Public Safety. Family attorney Cannon Lambert says the deal requires the county to have a nurse or EMT at the jail during all shifts and to install electronic sensors to ensure staff are properly monitoring inmates. Lambert says the county also agreed to help seek statewide legislation for better training of jail personnel. Sandra Bland's family also reached a monetary settlement for $1.9 million with the Texas County where Sandra Bland died. Closer to home, legislators are calling for a ban on fracking waste disposal in New York State. Andrea Sears reports.
State legislators are calling on the Department of Environmental Conservation to close a loophole in waste regulations and ban the disposal of fracking waste in the state. New York State banned fracking last year, but solid and liquid fracking waste from out of state is still going to New York landfills. State Senator Liz Krueger says due to a long-standing loophole, waste from oil and gas operations is exempt from being classified as hazardous. And new waste management regulations now being considered don't change that.
We could significantly improve the status of our water remaining clean if DEC applies the stricter definitions in the regulations they are finalizing literally as we speak.
Fracking waste can contain hundreds of chemicals, including carcinogens and radioactive materials. 20 senators and more than 30 members of the assembly have signed letters calling on the DEC to close the loophole and ban disposal of all fracking waste in the state. Under the proposed DEC rules, out-of-state fracking waste would still be allowed in landfills, and as Senator Brad Hoylman points out, the wastewater from low-volume fracking operations contains so much salt that it's spread on roads as a de-icing agent without routine testing.
It still might contain some very toxic substances like radium and lead. Those can be harmful to pedestrians and drivers, wildlife, local ecosystems.
20 New York counties have banned fracking waste, but statewide bills introduced in both houses of the legislature have failed to pass. Liz Moran with Environmental Advocates of New York says the state doesn't need to wait for the legislature to act.
This rulemaking on Part 360 offers a crucial opportunity for DEC to ban the improper disposal and road spreading of these wastes.
The public comment period for the proposed regulations ended this week. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. On Bill Bratton's second to last day as NYPD police commissioner, he went to the Brennan Center to address a conference on police accountability in the digital age. He made reference to a consent decree which came out of Floyd versus City of New York, the stop and frisk case. The judge, Shira Shinlin, found the NYPD liable for a pattern and practice of racial profiling and unconstitutional stops, and body cameras for officers were ordered. Bratton said the department is moving slowly in this regard, that it's a complex issue.
This is something that came out of the Stop Question Frisk lawsuit that was referenced earlier, and we are being required to do it, but we would have done it anyway. I'm a great believer in them. But I don't think I know anyone who's actually unhappy about this, including the cops. Cops are more than happy to have their side of the story on video with the full context. Cameras of today allow you to be recording constantly, but then deleting constantly. But the ability when that camera is actually manually turned on, that it is able to start 30 seconds or a minute before the time of the button being pushed. So it oftentimes will capture the precipitating incident that is requiring the officer to activate the device according to our policies and procedures. So the technology involved is very, very significant. Cops understand that just partial stories that end up on YouTube, where the camera only starts rolling when the incident has already reached an intensity that calls the attention of others. We believe that what the body cameras show will benefit all of us. We believe they'll help everyone see things from a wide variety of points of view.
Bratton says the cameras will be useful to know the truth in interactions between the public and police.
And ultimately, we're embracing this technology, because I think it will deal very effectively with the he said, she said issues. Based on other agencies' experiences, we think it will also significantly reduce the number of people who lie about their interactions with the police. I know you're shocked to hear that people actually lie about what has happened between them and the police and their encounters. And on occasion, police officers lie also. It will also reduce the number of the times those cops who might be tempted to lie about their interactions with the public, because basically it's there on video for all to see. But too often people don't understand the powers of the police. Too often they lodge complaints without understanding that the officer has a right to do certain things. The cameras have the potential to show the courts who interpret the laws and the oversight agencies who assess our actions. The Inspector General, I think this afternoon one of your panelists is our Inspector General, the Federal Monitor, the CCRB, and the public and the media that we are acting appropriately or when we are acting inappropriately, that there's no backing away from that inappropriate action. This will improve the community's appreciation of our role and the legitimacy of our actions, which is the majority of what we do. Not at all trying to minimize that there are those occasions when officers engage in activity that is illegal, inappropriate, or in violation of our policies.
But police surveillance and overreach is an issue of concern at the Brennan Center conference. The NYCLU's attorney, Mariko Hirase, brought up privacy issues. She referenced controversy over stingray tracking devices. These are also known as cell site simulators. And also the privacy issues in the Raza case, where the NYPD suspicionless surveillance of mosques and Muslim citizens was challenged.
That program, the suspicionless surveillance program, included components, technological surveillance components like pointing cameras at the entrances of mosques, reporting of using license plate readers in order to capture the people who are attending the mosques. And in a case that went up, so there was a similar case that was also filed in the District of New Jersey against the same program that went up to the Third Circuit. And the Third Circuit made very clear that, yes, this kind of discriminatory surveillance causes harms. This is a concrete harm, and this case can go forward. So I think it's very important to keep an eye on equal protection claims as we move forward and to think about how new surveillance technologies are impacting minority communities. There are lots of concerns in this area. Just a few weeks ago, the Center for Media Justice and the Color of Change and other organizations filed an excellent complaint with the FCC regarding the use of stingrays in Baltimore, which showed that, which mapped the areas that the stingrays were used, and it showed that they were being disproportionately used in minority and low-income neighborhoods, which raises a concern because stingrays also have the effect of interfering with cell phone service. So if it's being used in certain areas, that's going to have a negative impact on the entire community. Similarly, EFF has done a study showing that automatic license plate readers were being used in Oakland in communities, disproportionately in communities of color. And we can imagine that there we would see similar patterns with other surveillance technologies. And history teaches us that if we allow surveillance to be used without proper oversight, that there is going to be abuse. And there is going to be a disparate negative impact on minority communities and on political groups who are expressing dissent.
Another area of concern is social media. Bill Bratton touted the NYPD's use of social media, where he says the department is reaching out in new ways.
I believe as of this morning, I think I have in excess of about 50,000 followers on my Twitter. Every one of my precinct captains does Twitter. Almost all of my senior leadership, from chief of detectives on down to chief of patrol, chief of department, use Twitter. We use Facebook. If it's out there, we're using it because we want to reach the public. We want to hear from the public. We've already been also using it to follow criminal crews. We monitor social media. We monitor it exhaustively for traditional crime as well as for terrorism.
Bratton says he made it a priority to communicate through social media platforms, and he says they can use it to communicate with more accuracy than the media.
And specifically, Twitter has proven to be a tremendous effective way for us to connect with communities we serve. We used to rely almost entirely on the whim of the media, with their newscasts, their newspapers, and what they would choose to publish versus what we were presenting, what they would choose to edit. We now have the ability to go around the media, to basically cut out the middleman and go directly to the public. And the success and effectiveness of that, and there are a number of the media in the room here, they will tell you that they all monitor our Twitter sites, our Facebook sites, and very often you'll see news created by us that they would have otherwise ignored, because what are they watching? Trending. If something's getting 40, 50, 200,000, a million views, they recognize that, well, maybe this is something we want to report on through our medium. The revolution in this area occurred during the Boston Marathon bombing. Ed Davis, Commissioner of Boston Police Department, had implemented that system a year or so before the Boston Marathon bombing. And throughout the events of that horrific event, the Boston police were continuously updating the public with real-time factual information. While many of the legitimate media outlets, some of the traditional TV and news media paper outlets, were reporting erroneous information, the Boston Police Department was able to correct it almost instantaneously, forcing the media, with its urge to effectively always try to be first with breaking news, to take a step back and basically work harder to validate the source so they would not end up being repudiated by, in our case, a police department that has the ability to get out factual information much more quickly.
But the use of social media by law enforcement brings with it privacy concerns and problems using it without proper training or setting parameters on its use. Jemana Musa is with the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She says there can be a real difference between one's online persona and one's real life.
You get on someone's Facebook and you think their whole life is like toes on the beach and a drink on a rooftop and, you know, some other fabulous thing, or their kids doing this really particularly funny, adorable thing, rather than, you know, their kids having just destroyed the house and scratched their car with a rock and nothing got clean, you know, whatever their life might actually look like. And so, you know, I think in that it can both be the platform to make yourself look better, look tougher. It could also be part of the politics of navigating your life. And so I think that's one of the things that we need to think about. Like, for folks, particularly live in neighborhoods that are targeted for gang activity, gang databases, tracking gangs. They're usually low-income communities or communities of color, and sort of if you go back to the analog age, you would actually see as they're creating gang databases, and we have seen things like putting someone in a database as a gang member because they wore a crucifix. Catholics beware, right? Like that's, but that, you know, in a particular community, in a particular child, that was enough to get them put in a gang database. And that's a story out of North Carolina. It's not, you know, fiction. And so when you take it online, what does that mean? You know, right now, if you live in these communities, there's laws, there's ways you operate in your hood, in your barrio, in your community, right? Where there may be some people who are involved in some nefarious acts. And then there's also people who live there and go to work and go to school, and they all know each other, and they may be related to each other. And, you know, maybe your cousin is dealing and, you know, involved in some other activities, but they're also your cousin who comes to Thanksgiving, and they know that, you know, you're the honor student who is trying to maybe be the first person in your family to go to college. And so there's even like an unspoken code amongst people in the neighborhood where even some folks who are involved in more nefarious activities are still friendly with and supportive of and sometimes sort of circle the wagons around, you know, some of the folks that they think may make a difference or do something differently. And people all know each other. So those sort of relationships are fluid. And so when you look at it that way, I think it's very difficult to try and then take that apart on social media and figure out, so you're in the picture with this person, and then you've liked, you know, 27 of their posts, and you liked a post about a fight, but maybe you like that post because you know better than to not like it, because you still got to walk through your neighborhood to get to school or get to wherever you're going. And so all those sort of complicated factors that go into things don't come out in, you know, the guy who's like, well, I use Facebook, so I'm going to be my police officer who's going to sit and monitor Facebook and figure out how I can stitch these people together. It's not unusual that people who live in a neighborhood have intertwined lives or even find themselves part of the same crew. You know, being part of a crew can even be like, it can be an honorary term more than anything, right? Not that you're necessarily the one who's out there in the midst of something, but, you know, these are the folks who look out for you, the folks who got your back, and that's how you function.
And Musa says algorithms, software programs which are supposed to diagnose problems among social media users, can then be used in cases, and that intent is being drawn from Facebook posts and Twitter to prove and enhance charges. She says she didn't grow up online, that it's generational.
You know, my parents never had little funny stories about me when I was a kid, and then the stupid things I did when I was in high school and college and all those other things, but there is generations of people who are now growing up online. And, you know, I mean, it's been said, this is very redundant. We all know there are stupid things that we did when we were young, stupid things you say when you don't think this really means anything, ill-advised actions, all of those kinds of things that never became part of, at least for me, for when I grew up, part of a permanent record. And so the idea that you're almost creating this permanent record, because it's not like there's a limitation as the police start to gather all this information that says, well, when this person is 18, we toss all of this. Or if we've had it for 2 years and nothing's come of it, we toss all of this. So now you're sort of having your permanent record created for you based on whatever you might fire off, you know, in a like a retreat in action, a photo on Instagram that the San Francisco officers saw. And it's almost like criminalizing people for life based on the stupid things they do when they're a kid or the situations they get themselves in. And I think I think that there's something to that because it's also the question of interpretation of what they're doing online. And so I'm just going to give an example from my own life. I am on Facebook. And so on my Facebook, I am friends with a former Guantanamo detainee. So, you know, it's something I've done through my work. I knew him. I'd actually been at events with him. We are friends on Facebook. We communicated on Facebook. What does that say about me? What does that say to an algorithm? If I think about things like even when you talk about people's different personas, I don't know if you all are familiar with the term of code switching, but we communicate with people in different ways depending on who we're with. You know, are these my people? Are these different people? Am I at work and I'm talking very officially? Am I with my family and I talk very differently? For myself, I mean, I come from an Arab family. Arabic was my first language. I speak very differently in Arabic and English, and I recognize this about myself. And when I talk to people in Arabic, I'll often refer to people as my brother, my sister. I will say, Allah gets, it's all in the conversation everywhere, right? So people ask me how I am. My answer, usually in Arabic, is, Khair, alhamdulillah. I'm good, praise God. I don't say praise God when I speak to people in English. It's not part of the communication in the same way for me. It just isn't. I talk to my friends differently than I talk to my work colleagues. So what happens when that conversation goes online, right, and nobody is taking all that into account? You will find Allah all over my Facebook page, and I'm friends with a Guantanamo detainee, and who knows what else. What can come of that, and what record does that create about me versus what I'm actually doing, you know, and what my intentions are and how my life is lived? There's no context. There's no thought process behind that. So I think there's sort of like many, many levels on why this can be really troubling, especially without any kind of protections or parameters on how it's used.
There was much more discussed and unveiled at the Brennan Center Symposium on Policing and Accountability in the Digital Age. For more, go to brennancenter.org. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, September 15th, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Johnson and Andrea Sears. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.